Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This podcast is part of the Planet Broadcasting Network.
Visit planetbroadcasting.com for more podcasts from our great mates.
Hello and welcome to Book Cheat, the book club podcast where I've read the book so you don't have to. My name is Dave Warnicky, and on each episode of this show, we look at one of the classics. And joining me to look at such a classic, it's a returning guest for a returning author, it's Matt Stewart.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I assume you're talking about me as the returning author. Yes, I have penned a few tweets in my day, and I think of them all as little short stories.
And they're all bestsellers, is that right?
They are. Yeah, if you count like three or four retweets, handful of favourites.
I think that's all it takes to get on top of the New York Times best-selling list these days.
It's changed. The economy is very different now. No one's buying books. They're liking tweets.
Right?
It's so good to be back in the hen house here with the book chook.
Now,
pecking away.
Thank you so much for joining me again. I've got to say, have I made it up to you yet? Because you were on the first ever episode of this show, and then nearly went a whole year, you told me, without me asking you back, and now I've had you on the last three of the last four episodes.
Yeah, can you stop it, actually? I've got other things to do.
Yeah, and I thought that might be the case. I'll just keep asking you back until you say, all right, actually, I don't want to be part of this anymore.
This is such an honor to be one-on-one with the master. Can't believe it.
I think this is the... Yeah, we were talking about this before. I've just worked out this is the first one-on-one episode. It's me, you, and today, Edgar Allan Poe. But we'll get to him in just a minute. Whoa.
People would be paying top dollar to be one-on-one with the Chook, I reckon.
Well, you have, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of the deal was we were going to keep the money quiet. But yeah, okay, now the secret's out. I've paid a pretty penny.
Yeah, you pay a pretty penny and you get to be on three or four of the shows.
Yeah, you get to sit and listen. You get to sit at the lap of the master booksman.
Thank you.
Is that how you think of yourself?
Every day, yes.
I'm really looking forward to getting into this. I've just finished I think I've talked about it on the last few appearances. I make my way through books very slowly, even when they're audiobooks, because I listen to them about 45 minutes at a time. And the one I've been listening to is a pretty long one. I think it was about 9 hours long or something. Leonard Cohen's biography by Sylvie Simmons, and it's called I'm Your Man. It was a great listen / read.
And did it detail his entire life? Because he lived a long, long life with many decades of music.
Yeah, it went through it all until it actually finished before he died. So it ended with him going in to start the recording of what would become Popular Problems, which wasn't even his last album. So that was the album before that many saw as his last album. And then he enjoyed it, released another one 2 years later, and then another one 2 years after that. Then he died, and that didn't stop him. He released another album 3 years after, or a couple of years after he died, he released one last album.
He's that good.
Which takes skill.
Yeah.
He recorded the vocals with the, I believe, obviously the book didn't get this far, so this is unconfirmed, but I'm pretty sure he recorded the vocals and discussed with his son how he wanted the music to go. And then his son organized, included playing himself the last album, which was all his final albums all got rave reviews. He was just on a hot streak in his 70s into his 80s.
That's amazing, isn't it? Best work in your 80s.
The highest chart, his highest charting albums of his career, I think, in America were in his last four albums, I believe.
Wow. I mean,
which is.
One can only hope, gives us all hope, right, to be in the top 10 in our 80s, finally?
Totally. It has definitely... He was older than you are now when he released his first album. So there is... You actually got a head start on him with your work for Weed Hornet.
Weed Hornet, thank you. Yes, released our...
Australian ska band.
Yes, released our first EP in 2004. So got quite the head start.
When you were just a baby.
Yeah, I was
but
in
he,
the
I think
the
his
womb.
First album came out when he was 32 or 33.
Wow. And how old was he when he used his first hypnotism to get his maid to strip for him, as mentioned on the first time you brought up this book on this show?
I think it was when he was about... I think he was 8 years old. Wild. Wild story. And it's just a little footnote at the start of his life. Yeah, different times. The 30s, I reckon. You know, people were hypnotizing their maids, getting them to get naked. Yeah, there's something really off about that story, but... Do you reckon... Anyway, I don't want to cast aspersions about this maid, but a grown-up going, no, that boy, he made me strip with his mind.
Maybe he was that
all
good.
All right, lady, come with us.
He was that good, he transfixed maybe. People for 8 decades.
Yeah, that's true. so I've finished that now. I'm looking forward to getting onto the next book, which is Aidan Simpson's second novel, just arrived in the mail. So looking forward to getting cracking with that one. A physical book too, Dave.
Really?
You'll be happy to hear. Yeah.
Do you remember how to read?
I've become like a real hipster, you know? It's like going to vinyl. Yeah, Spotify's fine, but I really like to hear the richness of the needle on the vinyl. It's the same with me and books. You know, all the kids read audio books, but for me, it's all about that page.
Yeah, kids these days don't even know that books used to come in book form.
That's right.
They don't even know what you're talking about. Books? What do you mean? Audiobook? Yeah.
Send me the MP3, old man. Yeah.
Well, today you are joining me for... It's the first one-on-one. It's also... This is the first ever crossover podcast. We are crossing over between three of our podcasts. So you and I and Jess Perkins host Do Go On, a comedy history show. Then you started the spin-off Primates, where you look at primates in popular culture, things like King Kong, or that episode where we covered the Troy McClure Planet of the Apes musical on The Simpsons, if you remember, Matt.
Oh, I mean, so many classic moments from the Primates oeuvre.
There's so many. And you were just about to...
I sound that right?
Yeah, I think so. Is that what a chimp would say? We're about to... Well, you're about to celebrate 100 episodes of the show and go on hiatus. Before doing that, we thought we would do a triptych crossover between our three podcasts. Of course, Book Cheat, we look at books. So what we've got here is Edgar Allan Poe's The Murder in the Rue Morgue.
Oh, and I think I learnt on this week's Do Go On that this was the first ever detective novel.
That is right. Absolutely. That's why we are covering it. And then on Do Go On, the episode that comes out the day after this comes out, so most people, by the time you hear it, will be out, is about the life and mysterious death of the book's author, Edgar Allan Poe, which is a crazy, crazy life he led.
The thing I'm most fascinated about finding out is, where do the monkeys come in?
And because you are the primate primatologist, or host of primates, at the very least.
Amateur primatologist.
Yeah, thank you. There is I don't want to give away too much, but possibly a primate might appear in this novel, making it a three-way crossover.
I like it. You're holding the cover up there, and there's clearly an orangutan.
Shh.
Is that right?
Shh. There is an orangutan on the cover. Because I wanted to show you the cover, Matt, and I'll put a photo on our Instagram and Twitter and Facebook for a book cheat. Because I don't know if you know this, Matt, but you actually own 50% of the novel I'm holding in my hand now. This isn't just mine.
Oh, right. Wow.
Last year in November, we were lucky enough to tour Ireland and the UK with our Do Go On podcast. And after the show, sometimes people would give me books in the hope that I would do them on the show, which was absolutely lovely. Give me a classic book. And then Russ Brown gave me Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. And he's got a little message for us here. It's written on the inside cover. So, dear Dave and Matt, I got you this book to share. You should do a crossover podcast with Book Cheat and Primates about this. I mean, come on. Look at the cover. That is one seriously gnarled and jacked up ape. Plus, it's reportedly the first ever detective novel that inspired Arthur Conan Doyle, etc. Love you guys and Jess. Cheers. Russ Brown. Bath, 2019, baby. Then he's written in brackets, Bristol. Fuck, I forgot it's Bristol this time. Shit, don't read this bit. Fuck.
Oh, that's great. I was saying to someone the other day, I was around at my folks, actually. I was probably saying it to my mum, but she found a book that was given to me when I was four, and it had an inscription from my auntie and uncle who gave it to me with the date and everything. I'm like, that's every book that's a present should have an inscription and be dated on the inside.
Definitely.
I reckon it's a real fascinating sort of time capsule.
Yeah, definitely. And so big thanks to Ross for giving that to the both of us. This one has also been suggested by Alec McElroy from Kansas and Sean Spinner from Boston, Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. Beautiful. God's country.
Beautiful place.
Beautiful place.
Apart from the cover that I've just shown you there, do you know much about this book, this short story?
Only from what I learned on Do Go On this week, where you said it was the first ever detective novel. So I'm guessing it's some sort of Agatha Christie-esque or like you said before, Sherlock Holmes-esque sort of story. But yeah.
You would be correct in guessing that, absolutely. So I'll tell you about it. The Murders in the Rue Morgue is a short story by American writer Edgar Allan Poe. It first appeared in, and we talked about this on the podcast on Do Go On, Graham's Magazine in April 1841, while Poe was working on the magazine as the editor, Graham's Magazine.
And you also said, despite it sounding like a backyard operation, it was legit and actually quite a decent publication.
Yeah, that's right. And he was actually, he didn't get paid too much during his lifetime. It's so funny how influential it has been 150 years since. But he didn't make too much money from writing in his lifetime. He struggled a lot, but he got paid fairly well for this, apparently. It is often pointed to as the first detective story ever written. It had profound influence on popular culture, especially influencing Arthur Conan Doyle to create Sherlock Holmes. So there you go.
That's cool. You're a big Arthur Conan Doyle fan as well, aren't you, Dave? You love a detective story.
I love a detective story, especially with... which is what this has, an eccentric character at the center of it, a Hercule Poirot, a Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
A Dr. Mrs. Mark Sloan Marple. From Diagnosis Murder, for example.
Yeah, or what Murder She Wrote. Is she isn't eccentric?
Yeah, well, I guess so, a little bit. Jessica Fletcher.
Yeah, Jessica Fletcher, that wildcat.
She can't be tamed.
Oh, it cannot be tamed. Yeah, absolute eccentric type. Mild-mannered novelist.
All right, well, I always start with the opening line or the opening few lines, and just to paint the picture, and this is how The Murders in the Rue Morgue starts. The mental features discoursed of as the analytical are in themselves but little susceptible of analysis. We appreciate them only in their effects. We know of them, among other things, that they are always to their possessor, when inordinately possessed, a source of the liveliest enjoyment. What do you think of that? That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, and you know, somewhere in the middle, I got distracted for half a second, and it made absolutely no sense to me. I have no idea what that meant.
It is the kind of point where you're listening on the audiobook and you're rewinding 30 seconds just to try and catch up. Sorry, what is he talking
about? If I could have, I would have rewound you then.
Well, I've got to tell you, the first few pages are written like that, and it's a little bit confusing, but it eventually sort of makes sense. So our story is told to us by an unnamed narrator, and it goes on like that for a few pages. The narrator at length tells us about two ways to approach a problem and uses examples of each. The first is chess, or draughts. A game enjoyed by intelligent people with sets of moves with an emphasis on memory and playing by the book. You know, there's a standard way to play chess for the most part. The other example he gives, however, is a game of whist, a card game that was big in the 19th century, a bit like bridge, where the game has rules, but a good player examines his opponent and deduces clues from their body language and facial expressions as well.
Okay. So that sounds fun. Maybe.
So he's talking about how some people just use their mental intelligence, but other types use their mental intelligence as well as examining and putting clues together from things that they observe.
Right. This does sound like this is Sherlock Holmes.
Right, exactly. That kind of person, like deducing things from observation. The narrator introduces us to this way of thinking with reason and imagination and explains that the story we're about to hear will make sense in terms of that second kind of thinking with the observations. So that's the little intro to suck you in, which, to be honest, I had to push through the first few pages, but then the story starts and it gets good.
But I guess before this was all a bit of a cliche, that's probably all very fascinating.
Totally. That's what I got to keep reminding myself. When I was reading this, I was like, I got to remember that this was never done before. None of this. So you got to give the guy a lot of credit.
Yeah, cut him a bit of slack.
Yeah. So the narrator introduces us to a character that he became acquainted with in Paris, where our story is set. A young man by the name of Monsieur Auguste C. Dupin. Dupin was from a wealthy family originally, but had fallen on hard times. He had enough money to just scrape by. His only luxury was books. Well, kids, do you know what those are?
Well, I mean, he'd hate these days.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do.
My only luxury is MP3s.
Yeah. A Kindle. I'd die for even a Kindle.
Give us a Kindle. So the narrator met Dupin one day when they were at a library in Montmartre in Paris, and both reached for the same book at the same time. So a really nice meet-cute moment.
Montmartre, that's a Parisian suburb sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Sure, I did the walking tour of Montmartre.
Yeah, a lot of sites around that area, definitely.
That's where there was, is that sort of vaguely near the bloody, what's that, there was a musical about it a while ago with high kicks and stuff.
Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, I think if I'm not confusing memories, I think it's in that area. And it's also, there was some tales about Picasso as well, living around there somewhere.
He's
quite a famous artist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard of him.
Pablo, to his friends.
Oh, right. Of which, of course, you are one.
Yeah, that's right. We're pretty close, me and Pabs.
You're pretty close.
Really close friends calling Pabs.
You may have been to a place he once lived, maybe.
I think I might have walked past one of his apartments. I think I know Pablo Picasso.
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, you could say. So they both reached for the same book and then met each other. They then kept running into each other here and there around Paris, having little bits of conversation to the point where they agreed that the narrator could rent with Dupin whilst he stayed in Paris, because they're both looking for a place to stay and they could split the bills, basically.
Right. I think that's good. That's smart. Thriftiness, you know, some people are like, hey, look down my nose at you. But I think that's just smart. That's just, you know, nothing wrong with a little bit of thrift. Dave, what do you think about that?
I'm with you.
I mainly like it because I love the phrase, the phrase that is absolutely escaping me right now.
Which you absolutely love. I'm trying to pad
for
you.
I love that. I love that term.
Thrift.
So much that it is I've absolutely blanked on it.
If you think
I should have had a Dare iced coffee.
Instead of a tea. If you think of it, let me know. Your face is lit up. You are on Google, aren't you? Are you trying to Google thrift phases? Or phrases?
How do you spell economic? Economic. Thrift. Ness.
I got to tell you, this better be a good phrase now.
Oh, man. What is this fucking phrase? It's not even thriftness. What is the... fiscally conservative is the phrase that I love.
What did you Google?
It was not worth it.
What did you Google?
I couldn't find it. Don't you have that thing where your brain only gives it to you once you've started Googling it? That happens to me all the time where I'm like, what is that word? And I'll start to Google and my brain will be like, oh, yeah, I didn't realize you really wanted to know. I'll just tell you. You dog. My brain is such a dog. In the bad way. I know you love dogs and you probably heard that as a compliment.
Love a dog. Yeah, great. Can I pat it?
Pat my brain. Yeah. Real soft. It's real. I got a real smooth brain.
So we're up to the bit where they've decided to live together in a moth-ridden old mansion. That's where they're living. They lived alone, welcoming no visitors and shutting out their former acquaintances. Dupin had a knack for deducing information about people based on their appearance and thought patterns alone. The narrator gives us an example. One night they were walking together, and the narrator, they'd been silent for about 15 minutes on the walk. He was silently in his mind thinking about an actor. When Dupin said out of nowhere, "He's a very little fellow, that's true, and would do better for the theatre des varieties." The narrator says, "There can be no doubt of that," I replied unwittingly. And not at first observing the extraordinary manner in which the speaker had chimed in with my meditations.
That's not just deduction. That's mind reading. You can't look at someone's facial expression and go, "I know what you're thinking." It's about the specific actor.
Yeah, well, he goes, "Mate, how the hell did you know what I was thinking? Like, that's crazy. Explain yourself."
And he said, "Elementary, my dear."
Well, he does that real Sherlock Holmes thing where he goes back through a list of things that all point in one direction that sort of set him off. So he explains that 15 minutes earlier, he observed the narrator get bumped in the street by someone carrying fruit that pushed him into some unmade section of the footpath, which made him think a long chain of thoughts explained in great detail in the book that ended in the narrator thinking about this short actor. And Dupin was like, "Ah, you're clearly thinking about this guy."
That's pretty ridiculous. So did that add up to you, the way it was explained?
Well, it was so overly complicated that I actually struggled to summarize it for the show. I was like, lots of thoughts. Suddenly he's thinking about a Greek god. You know, it's really all over the place.
And it's like he goes, "I know you're at this point now." Why didn't he think he was still at the Greek god part? He also knew how fast he'd be moving on this thought train as well.
Yeah, I think the final bit is he observes the narrator sort of stand up straight, and then he's like, "I knew you were thinking about how short that actor was."
That's great. I love it.
Basically, it's a plot device to show us his amazing ability to work backwards to form a conclusion and also focus on things in minute detail, which he's going to do in the novel. A real Sherlock Holmes type, I've written here, I hear you say. Well, that's because this character greatly influenced Arthur Conan Doyle and his creation of Sherlock Holmes. And Arthur Conan Doyle was very open about that. He praised Poe and was like, it wasn't like he ripped him off and then denied it. He was like, "Yeah, he's the one that created this thing. He inspired me."
It is an interesting thing, like the lines between inspiration and ripping off, you know, plagiarism versus inspiration. And it's the same with, like, you know, like musical genres. They all start somewhere and then the influence is passed on, and no one starts a band with a fully brand new sound, right? So I don't really know where you draw the line. It also is a thing where if it's one band that has such a distinctive sound and only one person is inspired by that, it's like you've ripped them off because there's only you and them who sound like that. But if a whole scene explodes, it's like, yeah, this is just a genre now.
Right?
Yeah, very confusing. Do you have an answer for me, Dave?
Well, no, because with the Arthur Conan Doyle thing, like Sherlock Holmes obviously is much more famous than August C. Dupin, even though he influenced him a lot. So it's really tricky.
Yeah, I think it's similar, like, you know, say Nirvana with the poster boys of grunge, but they weren't the ones who started the scene in Seattle. There were bands that came before them, like maybe Mudhoney and bands like that, I think. But, you know, it's just not how it works necessarily. One, it's about timing and luck and all these other things as well.
Totally.
I have to talk everything back through the grunge scene of Seattle in the early 90s. It's the only way I can make sense of the world.
Yeah, I've noticed you connect a lot of things back to that.
That's why I'm often muttering to myself, "What would Kurt Cobain do?"
And then you think, never mind. There you go. There's a reference. I was trying to think of one.
That's a good one.
So this plot, it's basically just to show that he's this out of this world thinker that observes things that no one else would ever know. Soon after this, our narrator and Dupin read a story in the newspaper detailing a horrible double murder at Rue Morgue, a street in Paris, where Madame L'Espagne and her daughter, Mademoiselle Camille, had been found dead in their home. Neighbours had been awoken by them screaming in the middle of the night. They also heard two voices from within the apartment, followed by silence.
Okay.
Concerned by the screams, the neighbours and the two police broke into the locked apartment to find a grisly crime scene before them, which included a blood-smeared razor, locks of grey hair, bags of money, and an opened safe. Ooh. But the two women were nowhere to be seen. The police did find soot in the room leading to the chimney, which was immediately searched and found to contain the body of Camille, who had been choked and throttled to death and then stuffed into the chimney feet first, so her head was at the bottom of the chimney.
Oh, Jesus. That is grisly.
Yeah. I'm afraid it gets...
And seems unnecessary.
I'm afraid it gets even grisly over this next sentence. Her mother, Madame L'Espagne, was found out in the back courtyard of the building, having been beaten and her throat cut so deep that when the body was moved, her head came off.
Shit. Yeah, that's no good.
He doesn't spare on the violence, Edgar Allan Poe, I must say.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that does. That feels like, modern day over-the-top gore, but it's always been there.
It's always been there.
It's always been there. You know, it's just a part of humanity. The darkness. At first I thought when you said it was a double murder, I thought someone had been killed twice. So this is obviously a very different thing and a very grisly thing. So,
it was actually a quadruple murder because they were both murdered twice.
Oh, they're both double murdered.
Yeah, it's a double-double murder.
Double-doubles are good in basketball, not so good in murder.
No.
I've always said that. Yeah, right. So I mean, obviously, got to put to one side how fucked up things are. You got to put to one side those sort of things and just concentrate on the intrigue. They've left a few tantalizing clues, haven't they? The locks of grey hair, the soot. Oh no, we understand what the soot was from. What was the other one?
But what could the soot be? Where could it be from?
Well, that's if it was in Poirot, that's what Inspector Japp would begin there saying. Yeah. I reckon the answer lies in the soot, Poirot.
Poirot's like, oh my god.
No, not Japp. That would be
Hastings.
Hastings.
Oh,
I say,
but Poirot.
What of the soot?
Do you think this soot has anything to do with it? Do you think so? I noticed a charming young lady down the street who seemed very innocent, and I'm very attracted to her. What do you mean she's the murderer? What? She seems so nice. She has a nice smile, Poirot.
And a beautiful car.
No, he's so easily taken in. Poor Hastings.
Yeah, but so the main clues there were the locks of grey hair. That feels pretty big. And then
there were
the open safe.
Open safe and bags of money. So,
right.
And at first, the police thought it was a robbery gone wrong, but the large sum of money left in the room quickly ruled that out. Like, why would you kill two people and then leave without the money if you wanted the money?
Why would you kill two people, take the time to put a body in a chimney, but leave the money?
Right. I mean, they could be dealing with an idiot. That is.
That's true. Imagine that Poe's just written. The big reveal at the end is, yeah, it was just a real dumb idiot murderer.
And people were like, well, it is the first detective story. This is still original.
Yeah. So does our man come in at this point?
No. So
is he already known as a crime solver in this world?
No, not known as a crime solver. Just a very smart thinker. But he's kept to himself, basically.
Right.
He's still reading the newspaper with the narrator and they're going, oh, because the crime's gripping Paris. Everyone's wondering, what's going on? And we hear more from the article. The newspaper also detailed the neighbours had heard screams and what they'd told police about them. They all agreed that as they ran up the stairs to break down the door, they heard sounds of a struggle and two distinct voices inside. One gruff and the other one shrill.
Oh, right.
Hey, what are we going to do about these bodies?
I don't know. I don't know what we should do with them.
He's like, shut up. It's 2 a.m. I can't deal with this voice right now.
Okay, so it's probably two murderers.
Well, and these,
double murderers.
These are the description.
Committing a double murder.
A double murder. By a double murder duo. Four. The people told the police, and this is put in the newspaper so Dupin can read it, they all agreed that the gruff voice was that of a Frenchman, but the shrill voice could be a man or a woman. They're not sure. Differing accounts. It wasn't clear what they were saying, and none of the witnesses could agree what language that second voice was even speaking, and it was speculated upon by each of them that it could have been speaking English. Someone said it was speaking Dutch, someone said it sounded Italian, another one said it sounded Spanish. But each of the witnesses were from these different countries. So there was an English person, a Dutch person, an Italian, and a Spanish person. And they were each sure that the language spoken was not from one of their countrymen. So the English person would say, it sounded Dutch to me. And then the Dutch person would say, it sounded Italian to me. And it went round in this circle where they all discounted each other.
Oh, so it's like almost like a reverse speaking in tongues where everyone can understand you. This is someone speaking in a language no one can understand.
So that's one big
part. Right. Well, and it's hard for me to avoid the cover of the book with the orangutan. But I mean, an orangutan does not sound like it's speaking any language.
Does it sound gruff or shrill?
Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to picture what an orangutan sounds like. I have to go back through my frames of reference, like Dunstan checks in. What did Dunstan sound like? Or
oh, hello.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, no, it's shrill.
Hi, I'm Dunstan, and but sometimes I sound Italian. Buongiorno.
Buongiorno. Just Dunstan here checking in. No worries.
He's always saying his catchphrase.
Au revoir. No worries. Dunstan off. Dunstan out.
Yeah, that's what he'd often say.
He always said that. He's always checking in, that guy.
Been a while since I've seen it, but yeah, I think that's how I remember it anyway.
So for the people in the book, that's one big part of the mystery. Where that voice was from, who they are, all that sort of stuff. The other is that it appears no one could have gotten out of the locked building. It was the doors and windows were all locked from the inside. But no killers remained. Where did they go? All very mysterious.
Oh, they're the best. They're the best clues. I love those ones where it's like, this, it doesn't add up. Mm-hmm. And where there's no way that the murderer could have got out, they're great little mysteries.
How do they do it?
That's the first bit that's really got me in. The locks of grey hair, I was dipping a toe into intrigue, but... Lock from the inside. I'm all the way in.
You love anything that locks from the inside.
Anything that's... It was coming from the inside. It was coming from the inside in a shrill voice.
Oh,
all right, I'm listening.
I'm trapped inside. The evening edition of the paper. So this is back in a time when there's a morning and evening edition of the paper. Reports a new development. The police had arrested Adolphe Le Bon, incredible name, Adolphe Le Bon, a bank clerk who had delivered some coins to the murdered women the day before they died. But apart from that, no real evidence seemed to have been laid against him, so they just assumed it was him.
Wait, what's the evidence?
He'd been at the scene of the crime delivering money the day before. And they thought, well,
right.
Maybe he scoped...
That's a low bar.
Scoped out the joint.
I can see why you might want to question him, but arrest him?
This is also the first example of the well-worn trope of the clever detective and the bumbling police force.
Right. Great. It's a great combo.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So there's the development that this Le Bon has been arrested. Dupin was already intrigued by the case, muses on this to the narrator, and that is basically, he knows Le Bon from a few years back. We don't know how, but he knows the bank clerk. They've done business together before. He knows he's innocent. So now he's got a reason to want to crack the case. He was already intrigued.
Right. But now he's all the way in. He's got a cash reward.
And he's also well-connected from his old... His family was well-connected. So he knows the prefect of police. So he contacts them and says, can I have a look around the crime scene? And being an old friend of this police prefect, they're granted permission to actually go and check out the crime scene for themselves.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So these are the... Because I always wonder about that. How do they first get there in, you know, these detectives that aren't really detectives?
Yeah, like you can't just turn up to a crime scene in real life and be like, can I have a squiz?
Yeah. And normally they start with the... you know, like Poirot or whatever. I think at he was already a world-famous detective when his stories began. Is that right?
Yeah, he'd been a police officer in Belgium before, yeah.
So he's got an in, right? Whereas, in Diagnosis Murder, he's always just there when there's a murder and his son's a cop.
Right, his son is the in. Barry Van Dyke is the in. Steve Sloan.
That's a pretty solid in there. Why is your dad the old doctor coming along? I don't know. He's my dad.
I can't say no. I
wanted to bring him. Can't say no. A couple of interesting things I've noticed. This is clearly in a pre-Third Reich world because I don't think Adolf is a very popular name anymore.
No, but back then, every second person.
Yeah. And also, did you know this? The name Le Bon means the Bon in French.
Really? Adolf the Bon?
Yeah. That's right. And I think because Bonbon or Bonbon means thank you very much or something like that. So I think Bon, the singular Bon just means thank you.
But not very much, just a little.
Yeah, that's right. So if you want to really give it to him, you say Bonbon.
Bonbon.
Bonbon. I think the only other Le Bon I know is the singer from Duran Duran.
Is that Simon Le Bon? Le Bon.
And he was obviously named after this guy. Very influential.
Wow.
But it's amazing how much this story, the first ever of its kind, is it's the exact same dynamic of Poirot and, you know, all the Agatha Christie ones. Oh, pretty much all of them. Shakespeare,
that's right.
Sherlock.
Macbeth.
Sherlock. I really confuse Sherlock and Shakespeare. My brain is not that smart, but... But they both start with the sh word, and they've got stuff to do with books.
I mean,
sh sound. Oh no! Stop me. Can you please go on?
Right, I will. So they're allowed to search the house, and afterwards, they went home where Dupin pulled out two pistols and told his friend the narrator that they were now awaiting the arrival of a man who might not be responsible for, but who would be able to explain the murder. And we're like, what are you talking about? He says he might not come, but Dupin thought he would, and if necessary, they should be ready to detain him. So that's why he's got the pistols out. Dupin,
this is cool.
Our smart, smart man, has identified a few things that should point to the killer's identity. First of all, he has a shrill voice with no recognizable words. Hi, hello, yes, it's me.
Bonbon,
oh, Bonbon, oh, Simon Le Bon, big fan, big, big fan.
Hungry like the wolf. What is this guy talking about? These words make no sense.
So none of the speakers of different languages could understand what he was saying because he was just making noises, is what Dupin has decided.
Right.
It wasn't a language at all. He goes on, this killer had the agility to get in through the window, which appeared nailed shut to police, but Dupin, upon examining, discovered that they operate by springs and can be opened from the inside, and that one of the nails was loose. Police were still baffled as to how he got inside, because it's like about three stories up this window, but Dupin hypothesized that someone of great agility could leap from the lightning rod... tall rod outside the window to the shutters of the window and then get in through the window that way.
Okay. Someone with great agility. Hmm.
I wonder who it could be. Simon Le Bon, perhaps?
Who could it be? Dunstan checking in.
Checking in and then accidentally killing two people. Dupin has observed...
Yeah, that doesn't add up, does it? No. Really?
Dupin has also observed that the killer has superhuman strength as he was able to shove the younger victim up a chimney, which is obviously pretty hard to do. Dupin notes that he's cruel and violent and also seems to have no real motive. Finally, he's also noted that giant fingerprints on Mademoiselle L'Espagne's neck and the hair that she had on her fingertips wasn't actually human hair at all. So what the heck is going on? I ask you that, Matt. What do you think's going on?
Well, I mean, it feels like the cover's got a bit of a spoiler on there, right? With the orangutan. Surely the orangutan's involved somewhere here, but they don't have silver hair, I don't think. I don't ever think the older orangutans do they? Gorillas get silver backs, I believe. As an amateur primatologist, I certainly know that is the case. But
well, I'm afraid you'll have to suspend belief on the colour of hair for just a moment here, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't even know that is true. But why? What's the other voice, the one speaking French? And why is he there? Yeah, very confusing.
Well, Dupin surmises there's only one explanation possible, and that is that the killer is an orangutan.
Agree to disagree. They're not killers. They're gentle giants. I would have believed if it was a chimpanzee, maybe.
Well, Dupin quotes from a textbook that he's read about orangutans, and that's how he knows this. He says, "Read now this passage from Cuvier. It was a minute, anatomical, and generally descriptive account of the large fulvous orangutan of the East Indian Islands, the gigantic stature, the prodigious strength and activity, the wild ferocity, and the imitative propensities of these mammalia are sufficiently well known to all. I understood the full horrors of the murder at once."
Wow. That is pretty amazing.
Yeah. He's
pretty, pretty amazing deductions.
So Dupin's theory is that the first voice of the Frenchman was from a man who just witnessed the murders but didn't participate.
Ah.
But who's not wanted to come forward with his story of being implicated in the orangutan's killing. Dupin still believes the orangutan is still on the run. But to try and lure this Frenchman, this witness, to him and the narrator, Dupin has placed an ad in a newspaper, and it reads like this. "Caught, a very large, tawny orangutan of the Bornese species. The owner may have the animal again upon identifying it satisfactorily and paying a few charges arising from its capture and keeping."
Yep. Yep. I reckon this guy's an idiot. He'll come in.
It's one of those classic examples of when you've lost something and you have to describe it to the person who found it to prove that you know. It's like, all right, lost an orangutan, have you?
It's like a...
How about you describe it for me, huh?
This is a bit big, sort of apish, sort of long arms.
Well, say no more. I've got him right here. You've definitely seen him before.
Got these big flanges on the side of its head. Sort of looks like its face is a plate. You could eat off its face. It's got a big, beautiful, platey head. Why do they do that? I'm sure I've learnt that. They've got plate heads.
Yeah.
But only the older ones.
Got to eat somewhere.
Fascinating stuff. That's true. Once you get older, you know, every animal treats their elders differently. The orangutans, they treat them like crockery.
That's the ultimate sign of respect, having a four-course dinner on your grandfather's face.
Oh, wow. Beautiful wake. Beautiful wake for a grandpa. We ate an absolute feast of his face.
Pass the salt.
That's how we wanted to go out.
Pass the salt. So they put the ad in the newspaper and they wait with their pistols for the witness to appear at their address given in the paper. Dupin believes him to be a...
Did you say Gibbon in the paper?
Yes.
Thought so.
Dupin believes this witness is going to be a sailor for... Also found at the crime scene was a knot tied in a way only used by Navy men. So, observing all the time. And
he had so much knowledge. See, I thought you were going to say he was an assailant, but no, I think both can be true.
Yes, that's true.
A sailor and an assailant.
These are the big two. So, what's going to happen? Well, the sailor arrived as predicted, and Dupin pulled his pistol out and told the sailor that he could have his ape back after he told him what happened. Dupin assured the sailor that he knew he was innocent. He just wanted to know the truth. The sailor agreed in part because he didn't want to see the banker who'd been arrested for the murder be punished for a crime he didn't commit. And this is another classic part of a detective story where the mystery is all explained at the end. So the sailor explained that he captured the orangutan while in Borneo and brought it back to Paris. He kept the orangutan hidden with the intention of selling it. On the morning of the murder, after a night out on the beers with the boys, or as Poe writes, quote, a frolic on the night, which I like.
That's better. That's better than beers with the boys.
A frolic. You go out for a frolic on the night?
Yeah, I'm up for a frolic.
I mean, who isn't?
Frolic of frothies?
Yeah, frolic with a froth. After the frolic on the froth, the sailor had returned to his home and had found that the ape had broken free from the cupboard where he was being held. So, not a great place for an orangutan. He was hidden in the cupboard.
Honestly, this guy, like, they're saying, we know you didn't do it. He is entirely responsible for these murders.
All I did was lock up an orangutan in my cupboard. I've got nothing to do with it.
That I smuggled illegally from overseas. I'm assuming illegally, otherwise why is he smuggling it?
Right, yeah. So he's come home to find the orangutan is broken free. The orangutan was sitting there with shaving cream on its face, and it was holding a razor in one hand. He'd obviously seen the sailor shave before and was imitating him. The Frenchman reached for his whip that he was using to control the animal, but the orangutan panicked and jumped out an open window, razor in hand. So, I do like the image of an orangutan shaving in this guy's bedroom.
I feel like this is the detective stories since then have followed nearly everything apart from... They all seem a little more believable than this somehow. Yes. Even the far-fetched ones where it's like, well, I won't spoil any, you've done that on podcast past, but, you know, when a whole town kills someone at the same time, doesn't tell, or something else like that, you're like, that's a bit far-fetched. But it's no, an escaped orangutan who was trying to shave ended up slitting someone's throat.
You're absolutely right. It's, because, yeah, sometimes there are mysteries like, they come back and it turns out that there was someone that the person that they murdered knew 20 years earlier, but they just didn't recognize them. It's like, how do they not recognize them?
Yeah. Yeah, they do a fair few far-fetched ones, but this does feel like the most far-fetched that I've come across.
So just to finish off what happened with... So the orangutans run out the window, razor in hand. The sailor chased him down the street where it saw a light on in a window in an apartment in Rue Morgue. The orangutan then proceeded to enter after climbing up the lightning rod, as Dupin guessed. The sailor followed and climbed up the rod, but couldn't make the leap into the window like the orangutan could, so he could only watch on through the window.
Right. While speaking in French.
Yes.
In a gruff voice.
Yes, and inside the apartment were two women with their backs turned to the window. The orangutan grabbed the older lady's hair and, quote, was flourishing the razor about her face in imitation of the motions of a barber. So he's like dancing around like a barber. I don't know where an orangutan from Borneo has ever seen that, but he's doing that.
Yeah, he's seen it. He saw it whilst trapped in a cupboard.
Yeah, they lived opposite a barber, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So the women started screaming at this point. The orangutan panicked and slashed the older woman's throat, and angered by the sight of the blood, it then strangled the younger woman with its large and powerful hands. The sailor had seen all of this, and when the orangutan realized that his, quote, master, for want of a better word, was watching it, it panicked and stuffed the younger lady in the chimney and threw the older lady out the back window. The two voices that the neighbours heard were his, the sailor, and the orangutan was the unidentified voice. So he was yelling at it through the window, and the orangutan was going, oh, I don't know what to do. I've just killed two people. And no one knew what it was saying.
Oh, it sucks. This is the most brutal animal cruelty story. it's anyway, it's rough. There's there's no winners in this one, really.
At this point, the...
apart from DuPont.
Yes, that's right. Well, at this point, the sailor also panics, slid down the lightning rod, and just ran away. So that is the murder. There is a conclusion to the story. DuPin and the narrator used the sailor's evidence to get Le Bon, the banker, off his charges. We never know how, but the sailor apparently found the orangutan and sold him to the zoo to make a tidy profit. So there is no justice in this story.
There's no justice at all.
DuPin explained the crime to the head of police, who isn't stoked to be outwitted by a member of the general public, which is obviously a future trope of many private detectives. He's like, how did you know this? You should leave it up to leave police work to the professionals, basically. The book ends with DuPin commenting to his friend about the police officer and his lack of imagination. He says, quote, "It's all head and no body, like the pictures of the goddess Laverna, or at best, all head and shoulders, like a codfish. But he is a good creature after all. I like him especially for one master stroke of cant by which he has attained his reputation of ingenuity. I mean the way he has," and then there's a French phrase, which I cannot pronounce, which translates as, "to deny that which is, and explain that which is not."
Fantastic.
So he's basically saying that he's not a great analyzer. He's not a bad police officer, but he's not a great analyzer like me. More of the chess player than the game of cards player, harking back to the simile at the start of the story, the two types of thinkers.
Yeah. And the phrase head and shoulders like a codfish, did that take off?
That is.
I love it.
That is beautiful stuff.
That's what a funny way to describe a cod. All head and shoulders.
All head and bloody shoulders, this thing.
Much like, I think we once talked about how snakes are all neck.
Yeah. A snake is all neck.
Snake's all neck. Cod's bloody all head and shoulders, mate. And, you know, fins and tails and stuff, but, you know, mainly head and shoulders.
If you know what I mean.
I do.
I thought you did. I thought you would. So that's the story.
So I really did. I really stuffed that up by mentioning the cover of the book at the start, I assume. Although people probably would have figured out the crossover nature of it, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, otherwise, why would it be a Pukchi crossover?
So it is. Yeah, nearly always the ending is not super satisfying with these things. Because especially when it's not, I don't know. How do you feel about the ending? It felt like it was. It probably at the time would have been amazing, but now it's like, all right. So this is pretty silly.
Yeah, I got to keep reminding myself. Like I was laughing at the bits where it's like, and suddenly the orangutan was shaving with a razor. Like, but
yeah.
Like we said at the start, I got to like keep reminding myself that this is the first one that no one else had done this. So it is amazing. Like in terms of. Like, it's creativity, but, like, there are definitely bits of the story that don't hold up like a modern...
Yeah.
A modern novel would.
Similar to The Raven, you know, one of his other famous ones. As a kid, it was my absolute least favourite episode of The Simpsons where they just read out The Raven and Bart was The Raven.
Yeah, I was the same at the time. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm gonna skip this one. Skip this bit.
Yeah.
But I thought, just to finish up before I get you to score it out of 5, I thought I'd talk about the influence of the novel to remind ourselves how, you know, how it did change a lot of things. I'm going to quote quickly from the Wikipedia page on the Murders in the Rue Morgue, which I thought fantastically sums up its influence. This is a quote from Jeffrey Myers, who was a Poe biographer. He said, "It changed the history of world literature. Often cited as the first detective story, the character of DuPin became the prototype for many future fictional detectives, including Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot. The genre is distinctive from a general mystery story in that it focuses on analysis. It established many tropes that would become common elements in mystery fiction. A lot of things that we've talked about, but just to recap, the eccentric but brilliant detective, the bumbling constabulary, so the police officer, the first-person narration by a close personal friend, much like nearly all the Sherlock Holmes stories are told by his friend Dr. John Watson. And back to the quote, Poe also portrays the police in an unsympathetic manner as a sort of foil to the detective. So that's That's that. And it would also, he would become a character in more than one story. So the story's Detective Dupin would reappear in two more short stories written by Poe, The Mystery of Marie Roget and The Purloined Letter, both a few years later.
Ah, so there was a little series that he started up.
Again, that's like a thing, you know, the recurring detective who keeps coming back and solving different mysteries each time.
Yeah, great. I love it. I'm a big fan. You got me into it, really. I'd seen a few episodes of this and that over the years, but your love of Poirot got me into it, and I've watched a good chunk of that series now. There's so many episodes.
I just love it. It's well made, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, because it's set in the past, even the episodes that were made in the late 80s, which are now older than I am, and they've always been older than I am, I should say that. There was no changing point in the way time works. But even those early episodes don't look that outdated now, like, say, any other show that was shot in the 80s do, because it was set during the, you know, the 20s, 30s, and 40s. It already has this older look.
It's pre-age.
It's great.
I agree. Yeah, it doesn't look dated at all, whereas you watch Diagnosis Murder from around the same time.
Yeah, it looks quite silly.
It's sort of like, it's charmingly aged and dated. But
yeah, the fashion, the cars, what's going on in their hairstyle, it looks a bit, you know, it's like, wow, this is very 90s.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, no, that's great. So if it wasn't for this book, none of that probably would exist.
It's amazing to think about the people that it influenced that then influenced other people that, you know, that it just got the ball rolling. Yeah.
Because it's the kind of thing where you go, at first I'm like, well, someone would have come up with it eventually, but not necessarily. And if they did, they could have come up with it in a different way and influenced people in different ways. And who knows, or, you know, butterfly wing stuff. It's a little theory I'm working on called the butterfly effect.
Oh, okay.
Where a butterfly flaps its wings, etc. That's one of mine.
Is that a Nirvana thing or?
Yeah. Yep. You know the cover of In Utero, those wings?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I think of them as butterfly wings.
All right, well, we've laid out why it's important, but what of the actual story, I'm going to ask you to give it a score out of 5, which you can, in your mind, you can factor in the importance, or you can just base it on the story alone. What do you think you're going to score it?
I feel like I'm going to need to factor in the importance, because, I mean, I love those kinds of stories. But this one, it was not a satisfying end. If this was an episode of Poirot, I would have been like, come on, mate.
But we definitely would have been able to cover, we've been looking for a way to cover Poirot and primates, but it just never happened, did it?
No, I just have not spotted one. We found a way with X-Files recently, and I've since found another episode, the Invisible Gorilla one, but, so maybe we'll do that one day, but... Yeah, all right, and you score them out of 5, don't you?
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to give it 3 out of 5, and that's bumped up a bit from importance perspective.
Okay, 3 out of 5. Fantastic. I have also factored in the importance of it historically for popular culture, and there I've bumped it up to a 4 out of 5 because of that.
Right. I think I was starting it pretty low.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
And apologies if any offences caused to the poor
I think that's fine, because I'm glad that I know about this and that you can think about how influential it is. But put it this way, I'd rather read a Sherlock Holmes short story than go back and read the second and third Dupin story, I think.
Yeah. You just pay your respect to it. It's like I appreciate the, you know, the football from the 1920s.
Yeah.
But I would much prefer to watch a modern game.
Yeah, that's right.
Even though I appreciate how great they were.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You realise it's important, but at the same time, you'd rather watch the new stuff.
Yeah. Although, that shows how good the writing of Christie was for you, because she didn't write those novels all that recently.
That's absolutely right.
Some
of those were created closer to the time of this being written than us being alive now. So she's more than, you know, she's not even the midway point, so.
What a master.
Absolute master. And I actually haven't done any Poirot stories on here yet. Few people have asked for them, so hopefully I'll get to them, because I do love talking about him.
Yeah, great. I'd love to listen to those ones. But do you think you're going to annoy, because you'll have a few lit heads listen to this show, obviously, and I imagine that would infuriate some, saying, oh, I mean, Edgar Allan Poe's no Agatha Christie. Would that annoy people?
Oh, possibly. And, you know, to each their own. I've also done Edgar Allan Poe previously. I did The Raven and also The Telltale Heart earlier on in this show. And it did make me appreciate it more than The Simpsons episode, reading The Raven back as an adult rather than watching it as an eight-year-old going, can we just get back to the normal Simpsons?
I haven't caught that. I haven't caught that episode of Book Cheat yet. I'll have to check that, The Raven.
Yeah, so, and I did like that. And The Telltale Heart is, you know, that's a great, a lot of suspense in there. So
I think, well, this is different, you know, like the way, because it's sort of like it's almost like there's a trick to it and there's a formula that's been improved upon from where he started. Yeah, I don't know why it's different that this version of a whodunit story has dated, but his other work hasn't dated so much, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I'm not making a lot of sense tonight. I feel like I've been off, Dave. I'd like to make a formal apology to your listeners. I haven't been on tonight, and I will probably, I expect to not be back on the show for another year, and I think it's deserved.
Put you back on the bench for a year. Well, yeah. I'm afraid we do not accept your apology because it is unnecessary.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Well, that does bring us to the end of the discussing the Murder in the Rue Morgue. But if you want to hear more about the life of Edgar Allan Poe, you can, of course, check out this week's episode of Do Go On. He died in, let's just say, weird circumstances. And we talk about that on the episode. And also, he lived
in depth, including his childhood and his upbringing, which was, all of it was pretty wild.
Yeah.
You know, some, yeah, he's had a very strange life.
Yeah, I think he also lived in weird circumstances as well. It was all weird.
Yeah. But also, I mean, other episodes that do go on that might interest book types, the bookish would be like, we did an episode, you also did a biography on Arthur Conan Doyle and how he created Sherlock Holmes,
and also,
which would probably mention this story, did it?
Yes, I think it talked about Poe's influence, but then we also talked about how Sherlock Holmes' creator, Doyle, at the end of his life, also had a very sort of strange back half to his life, believing in supernatural things. He was a big believer in fairies.
Yeah, he became very Mulderish.
Yes,
very Fox Mulder-y.
Definitely became a Mulder. And yeah, you can check that out. We also have done J.R. Tolkien, J.K. Rowling, Roald Dahl, all these people having different lives. Interesting lives, I should say. The Roald Dahl one, if you want to be a fan of him, maybe don't listen to that because he was not as great a person.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little... Yeah, I can't fully remember what it was, but I think it was... something about him being anti-Semitic.
Yes.
Perhaps. It's unfortunate when you look into people, great people from the past, you normally uncover something very unlikable about them.
We've...
often, like, real bad.
We've found that time and time again, haven't we?
Like, this Adolf Hitler guy, I don't know if you've heard. There's a few skeletons in his closet, let's just say that.
Okay. All right, maybe a future episode there.
Shakespeare is another one we've done on Do Go On. Was that another one of your reports?
I can't remember if it was me or Jess. I think it was me or Jess, I think. I've also done Agatha Christie and the time she disappeared for over a week.
Oh, that's right.
And the mystery of what
happened. Yeah, we've got quite a back catalogue of authorish stories. I wonder what other... I mean, yeah, maybe Book Cheat listeners are in a great position to suggest... good biographies or stories that relate to famous authors.
I've had a few people ask. Ernest Hemingway lived quite a rugged life with many adventures, so that might be worth tackling. I think that's a often suggested one.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear about him. It's funny. Yeah, all I know about him is I think he's portrayed in Midnight in Paris. That Woody Allen film. Another guy who, I don't know if you know, has had some bad accusations made about him. But there's also a line in a Nick Cave song where he says, But he died the Hemingway, which if we ever did an episode on it, I would understand that.
Lyric. I don't think it's a very nice way to go.
No, I think it might be a brutal way to go. Yeah.
But yeah, yeah, people can check out Do Go On. They can also check out Primates, which is your show you've been doing for over 2 years, or just up to 2 years, I guess, because you're hitting 100 episodes, including a live episode this weekend.
That's right. Yeah, if people are keen, they can get tickets. Maybe you can put a link in the show notes. Dave, hopefully you're going to make an appearance on there as well. You've been a guest many times before.
Great show. A lot of fun.
We've talked about a bunch of different Simpsons episodes and that sort of stuff. And we're about to record a little post-amble episode, which will go out this week as well, which will probably talk a little bit more about Poe's story here and a few other things. But yeah, if people are keen, they should definitely check out the Primates back catalogue. It's probably not as sophisticated as this show, but it's at least as fun.
Yes, definitely true.
I didn't realise the subtle dig there when I said at least. I mean, it's about as fun. I mean, it's at least as fun as this snooze fest.
This piece of shit. Well, before we go, Matt, would you mind if I gave a few shout-outs to people that support this show, as well as Do Go On and Primates, on a little thing called Patreon?
I would love it so much.
So basically, the way that we're able to do lots and lots of podcasts and put them out all the time is people support the shows on Patreon at patreon.com/dogoonpod, and in exchange, you will get 3 bonus episodes from Matt, Jess, and I now. Usually it's a bonus episode of Do Go On, so we'll report on a topic from history. We'll do a random thing like a quiz or some sort of trivia segment, something like that. And then we've now started a new Patreon-only podcast called Phrasing the Bar, where once a month we are going through the films of everyone's favourite actor, Brendan Fraser.
So good. I think it was a really, really good episode, getting great feedback about episode 1, which is about his feature film debut, depending on how you say it, which was Dogfight. A film that actually starred River Phoenix. Our man Fraser only had a pretty minor role, but it was memorable.
It was memorable. He had probably the greatest line in cinematic history, which I will not ruin for people, but it is. I'll never forget it.
I know. What a way to a real statement of intent, I'd say.
So, and people that support the show also get to tell me their favourite book, and as a way to thank them, I'll read out their name and their favourite book, and I've got 6 here. Would you mind if I read a few out quickly, Matt?
I would love it. I would love it a lot.
All right. Well, big shout out and thank you to Abigail Hansen. Thanks, Abigail, who's written in to say, my favorite book is City of Thieves by David Benioff. Historical fiction, which is my favorite genre. There you go.
Love it. Historical fiction. Yeah, that is a fun genre.
Yeah, where people take a...
messing with the past a little bit. Love it.
My mum...
It's history fan fiction.
Basically, yeah. Well, my mum's a fan of... there's like these crime novels that are... they're crimes that are solved by Sherlock Holmes creator Arthur Conan Doyle and his real-life friend Oscar Wilde. And they team up together and solve mysteries together. And she loves them.
That does sound fun.
All right, I'd like to also thank now a great supporter of the show, a man whose name we love to say, Jacoby DeAngel. On you, Jacoby.
Jacoby.
Which Matt likes to say is Jacoby every time. Jacoby has told me, my favourite book is The Hobbit by Tolkien. I've loved it for a long time, but it's only recently become my favourite because of how much I've been studying it as of late. The Hobbit has inspired my own writing, specifically a film script I'm working on. Good on you, Jacoby. He writes, hopefully Dave gets it into Book Cheat sometime in the near future. I'd like to do that, actually, The Hobbit. I would.
Oh, no, I think he was talking about his own script. Yeah. He wants you to cover
I'd also
that.
Love to do that, Jacoby.
I tell you, a quick tip for Jacoby, see if you can get Peter Jackson attached. I think that'll do good things for your script.
Really? That's a good hot tip.
Yeah, if you can get it. I mean, we're a bit close to him down here in Australia. He's just over the what do we call it?
Over the
pond?
Ditch?
No, across the ditch. We can have a chat if we bump into Pete.
Yeah, put it in.
Dave actually has a pretty good relationship.
Yeah, put
with
in
him.
A good word with PJ. The Jack, as I call him.
I always give. Wait, which one is he again? Is he the suit man or is he the director? Because I think I'm actually closer with the guy at the suit making Peter Jackson. But
only one of them has their own theme song that goes like this. Peter Jackson, doom,
Peter
doom,
Jackson,
doo, doo, doo,
doom, 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 doom.
I mean, which one's bigger? The one with the theme song or the other guy? Come on. I would also like to shout out now to Kendra and Eric Mickles. But Kendra specifically has written in, my favourite books are The Keeper of Lost Causes by Jussi Adler-Olsen and Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty. If you like Danish murder thrillers, but find Girl with the Dragon Tattoo to be too dark, the Department Q series by Adler Olsen is a fantastic. There you go. And also, she's got a postscript here. Leanne Moriarty is my favourite author, and I love all her books, minus her newest one, Cop That.
Ooh, I like your old stuff better than your new stuff. You tell them, Kendra.
Classic. On you, Kendra. Thanks very much. Rachel Johnson here. My favourite book is Outlander by Diana Gabaldon. Although I still call it by the original British and Australian title, which was Cross-Stitch. It's about the Scottish Highlands leading up to the Jacobite Rebellion in 1745, with the addition of a new time traveller from just after the Second World War. Rachel's got two copies. One of is 20 years old, which I had personally signed by Diana Gabaldon, the writer. And another one I bought as a souvenir when I visited Culloden. The scene of the last battle of the Jacobite Rebellion in Scotland. There you go, I've been there, and it's a very, yeah, a very emotional place. It's one of those places where, I don't know if it's the history that's made this happen, but when you're there, lots and lots of people died there. You could see cars driving not that far away, but it was so eerie, you couldn't hear them.
Right. Yes. I think my ancestors were involved there, the Stuarts.
That's right. Well, I think they were sadly on the losing side.
Yes.
So there you go. Thanks to Rachel. I've got a couple more here. Katerina Gutierrez says, my favourite book, purely from an angst teen point of view, is The Outsiders. It was the only book I was forced to read in high school that was moderately enjoyable. Thanks again to Katerina. Finally, Matt, I would like to thank a fantastic name here, Luigi Delos Reyes.
Oh my goodness, what a name.
Luigi's written, my favourite book is House of Leaves by Mark Z. Danielewski. It's a little pretentious.
Oh, I know this story, Dave. This one is, this is actually the untold story of the fourth little pig. Made his house out of leaves and the wolf absolutely tore it apart. I think that's why they cut it from the story. A bit stupid. A bit far-fetched. You're building your house out of leaves, pig? Come on!
What next? An orangutan that's going to be shaving? What are we talking about here? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, what are we in? Fantasyland? Get Mulder on the phone.
Luigi writes, it's a little pretentious and esoteric, but I still think that the atmosphere it creates is some of the best in horror fiction.
Yeah, well, I think he's filled in a little bit... A few of the blanks in my memory, but yeah, it was a horror take on the three little pigs and that mysterious fourth pig.
Whatever happened to him?
Well, he actually saw a barber and started mimicking shaving, and it all went horribly wrong.
With his little trotter.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much to everyone that supports the show on Patreon. One more time, it's patreon.com/dogoonpod. And, yeah, thanks very much if you are so inclined to do that. You get a bit of stuff for supporting the show and we get your support and we totally appreciate it.
Yes, and it's become quite a big mini network here. We've got the Do Go On Show where it all began, then Primates, this show, Book Cheat. I started a show as well with my cousin Sam called Listen Now, which is about going back through classic albums. The first season was going through the back catalogue of classic Australian pub rock band Cold Chisel. But the next season, which is going to start imminently, is going to be about different classic bands every week. And then I've also started another new show, Dave, because I can't get enough of it, called Matt Chat, which is a YouTube show. And Dave, you're actually on the very first episode.
Thank you.
So if people want to check that out, they can go to youtube.com/Matt Stewart. And yeah, episode one is a fun half an hour chat with me and Dave. And I've been learning a bit of editing as well, so trying to make it a bit more interesting. But you can look at our bloody pretty okay faces as you go if you want as
well. Our faces are there.
I might sorry to brag there, but yeah, they're pretty okay.
I'll link to all those things in the episode description, as well as a link to where you can suggest a book for me to cover on the show. And I'll give you a shout out if I choose that book, play, short story, whatever you want. But that does bring us to the end of the episode. Matt Stewart, thank you very much for joining us for this third of four times. And I'm sure we'll see you next week, maybe, unless you're busy.
Thanks so much for having me, Book Chook.
Thanks, mate. And until next week, as we always say here at Book Cheat, books forever!
This podcast is part of the Planet Broadcasting Network.
Visit planetbroadcasting.com for more podcasts from our great mates.
I mean, if you want. It's up to you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.